Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So this evening is the observance night, and it's also the Saturday, first kind of formal gathering since coming back and from Thailand, and I thought I would just recount some of my impressions, in that it's for myself going back every year. It's it's about 16, 17 years, and going back every year and seeing the changes both in Sangha and within the lay community. And then also, say, being more, more and more rooted here in America, then it's inevitable to draw comparisons and recognize different strengths and weaknesses. You know, and certainly they. Particularly this time, I walked off the plane and then got picked up and taken out to one of the branch monasteries of Ajahn Chah's, Ajahn Jundi's monastery. He was a very good teacher. It's just a little bit junior to me, and a very good monk, very well respected in our communities, and so that he had built a hall that is dedicated to Ajahn Chah, and so people, huge numbers of lay people, very large number of monks, over 400 monks. So that's, you know, over 400 monks, a few thousand lay people, all dressed in white, and everybody knows what to do, and it's a bit different. It's a bit different from here, and it's the sheer numbers of people involved in Buddhist activities and faith and commitment and devotion that is expressed there. It's quite very, very moving and very touching. And then also immediately meeting. A whole bunch of very senior leaders in the Wat Bopong Sangha, and it was very it was kind of, you know, of course there's the formal all night teaching and chanting and meditation, but then also there's kind of like the after alms round in the morning. A lot of the senior monks were gathered and just sitting around and chatting, and it was just so sort of warm and informal and unpretentious, and These monks have known each other for a huge amount of time, and everybody's very familiar, and kind of warmth and friendliness and teasing that goes on amongst them. It was really sweet with Ajahn Kampong was. I met Ajahn Kampong because he was here. He was here with Ajahn Sopa, and he was just sort of saying how much he'd appreciated his time here, and then there's a whole bunch of other monks around, and they started teasing him about, nowadays all your Dhamma talks are just about America. And so, yeah, we've all heard it already. it was just so sweet, the sort of teasing back and forth, and the obvious enjoyment of all of them, and the kind of warmth that's there. It's very, very lovely to see. it's easy to project onto these senior monks. These are incredibly dedicated and sincere, but they're also very, very human and very, very accessible. I think that's in terms of, say, Thai Buddhism, Thai culture, it's fairly easy for people to access the teachings and to receive guidance and example from people. So that was something that was sort of struck right from the beginning. And then I led a retreat in a retreat center in Bangkok, and I've done several retreats there, and they've fairly recently. I was finished a couple of years ago, but this is the first time I've, and there's been retreats going on at this place. It's a large center and very active. But they've recently completed a whole new facility, and the hall can go easily fit 400 or 500 people. And on the retreat there was 100 people. They kept the numbers at 100 to keep it so that there's plenty of space for doing walking and sitting meditation in the hall. And good facilities. But I think what was interesting was also seeing the people who were involved in the kind of leadership of the group, the people who came to help. With the, how do you say, the logistics of leading the retreat were all kind of urban, well-educated Thais and dedicated to supporting the meditation center and making sure that quality programs were being presented and administered to, and the person who kind of opened the retreat as a say the, as a lay leader, kind of a police general who's been meditating with his family for years now, and the person who came to close the retreat, somebody who was he's only been meditating for the last 4 or 5 years, but it's he was kind of a partner in Price Waterhouse Corporation of Thailand, and soon as which is a big global accounting firm, and after his first retreat, then he just scaled everything back, and he's more working as a consultant, more free time for family and meditation, just to and children are still fairly young, so he wants to provide a good example for an environment for his children to grow up in. So these are there's a tremendous amount of really dedicated interest within the culture and the society, and of course, it's being a Buddhist culture. Then there's the possibilities are there for people who want to pursue it, and there's lots of possibilities for all sorts of other things in Thai culture as well, but that is something that is really really quite interesting, and the range of people that were on the retreat, a lot of the age range, and from within the socioeconomic, within the culture, it's quite a range, and that was really nice to see. I taught a second retreat, and there was almost 150 people on that retreat, and there, again, a real range of ages, from about 16, 17 to 90. So it was it's so nice to see that kind of involvement and sincerity. You're going to Ubon to stay in at Wat Nanachat. It was interesting for me this time because it just it coincided with pretty much all the senior Western monks that were in Thailand. They were heading off the next day to go to India to meet with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. There was a big delegation from Thailand that went to meet with His Holiness, and kind of discussing the possibilities of intra-Buddhist meetings and collaboration and discussions, which haven't taken place for probably 1,000 years. So that on an official basis, but anyway, I ended up in Wat Nanachat, sort of as in the abbot seat again, and that was spending time with the resident community and the lay community. And I didn't really go anywhere other than stayed at Wat Nanachat, and of course visited Wat Bapong and Ajahn Liam, because also Ajahn Anaik went to India as well as the kind of leader of the delegation. And but just spending time with the community and the place where I had spent so much time, seeing on a daily basis, you know, even on an ordinary non-weekend, non-Buddhist observance day, that's probably, you know, around probably 50, 60 people come on a slow day, and come and help out at the monastery and help sweep up in the monastery and prepare the food offering, and then they go home. And there's a couple people, you know, I realize that have been Wat Nana Chant's been established for about 38 years, and there's a couple of the people that have probably come just about every single day for 38 years, and of course others who've sort of coming later, or who are just not as old as the others, it's just so much a part of their life, as part of your daily life cycle. As much as brushing your teeth and washing your face in the morning, is going off to the monastery and helping set things up, and then making the food offerings, and then going off to your fields or going back home, as one wishes. And that's it's incredible just to see that. And there's one woman who's been coming for years and years, and her son, she lives in a village sort of back from, in Tungborn, which is back, kind of back of Wat Nana Chant, and the monks go on alms round there every day, and her son, who is now a monk, has been a monk for probably 20 years. He's got his ninth degree Pali, which is like the highest Pali degree that he can possibly get. And he's actually living with Ajahn Amaro in Amaravati. He went there in last spring, and he can remember when he was a small child, going with his mother to put food in the bowls of the monks from Wat Nana Chant, and he can remember Ajahn Sumedho, this great hulk, for a tall, a tiny Thai village kid. And to see this 6'4" Farang coming into the village, and he said he can remember. It was winter time, and first time he saw Ajahn Sumedho, and he's just this little kid, who, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years old, and Ajahn Sumedho sort of asking him, now, boy. This means, is it cold? And there's this little kid putting food in his bowl. And you think of I just thought it was, this Mekong was relating that to me, of how that's his first memory of the monks going arms around in his village, and that and he became a novice. He was very very quick, very sharp, and he ended up going and studying in Ubon, and then down to Bangkok to study. And after he finished his studies, he's been putting a lot of effort into meditation and going to different, being in retreat, and now he's taking the interest to go to the West and reconnecting with a kind of Western Sangha. It seems that those roots were, the seeds were planted back in when he was a child. So it's, to me, that's just really, it's just very interesting, very kind of sweet thing. You realize that you know, those seeds that are planted, you don't quite know what's going to happen. You know, particularly a place like Wat Nanachat is really kind of an integral part of the kind of you know, the society, the cultural mix of in Ubon there. It's very much, very much accepted, and I mean, I can remember as the later days of being the abbot, and you know, really wanting to change the site of Wat Nanachat. It's going to get busier and more. It's going to be sort of less less quiet, but it never really came to anything, and it really felt at the time sort of whatever plan I put in place, the devas weren't in agreement. There, it just never happened, and sort of seeing it now as you say, yes, almost 40 years of the monastery being established, and you know, really is an integral part of the village and the Ubon area. It's a cherished part of the culture, which is really you know, quite delightful to see and to reflect on. And also in reflecting on time passing as well, where they're really noticing some of the, you know, when we were building Wat Nanachat and some of the projects that were, you know, just road and paths where, and forest clearance where you get all, the whole village out, and you know, seeing some of the young people at the time coming out and helping and being involved and seeing them. Yeah, I'm noticing on alms round many of their grandchildren around. It's a bit scary, actually, seeing, you know, recognizing that passage of time, the days and nights are relentlessly passing. How well am I spending my time? Say whether we're mindful, diligent, wise or not, time is still passing, and it's really up to us to make the best use of our time as possible. Seeing the you know, certain underlying qualities, I think, that are really helpful to be reflecting on as supports for our own practice, in that sense of you know, seeing that I think I mentioned last night of how Ajahn Chah saying the right practice, steady practice, you know, in that sense of how that steadiness and consistency of practice and being able to sustain the practice is really what is going to change the habits and conditioning and deeply rooted delusions that we hold, and that kind of steady practice is relies on the qualities of faith, patience, generosity and kindness, and those are qualities that just seem to come out within the a traditional Buddhist culture, and so those are qualities I think that we really need to be paying attention to. How do we nurture and support those aspects of faith, devotion, of being patient and kind of willing to stick with things, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, because we get blown around both ways. We experience something a bit difficult, so we get blown around by it, and to have that kind of steady and kind of enduring willingness to be present with what we're experiencing. But similarly, when things, there's kind of, they're pleasant, it's kind of interesting, exciting, it's easy to get swept away by that or get lose one's solid ground underneath one as well. So that it's easy to invest in a sense of me, a sense of self, both ways, that sense of either me, the hopeless meditator, or me, the next avatar or whatever whatever fantasy we're buying into at the time, and. You should realize, that steady practice of being willing to reflect on the experience that we have, the willingness to establish that mindfulness and awareness, willingness to be present and with it. And there's a quality of that quality of faith and devotion is plays a role in that. There's a tempering quality that sense of a heart quality of engaging with the practice rather than. It always having to make sense and analyze it and figure it out. Because on a certain level, it doesn't need to be figured out. It just needs to be lived. It needs to be, and one needs to give oneself to it. And of course, that quality of generosity is not just And yeah, that kind of the generosity isn't measured in terms of material offerings, but it's a way of engaging that the heart of giving and giving to and giving up and relinquishing, so that in terms of practice, to be able to really give oneself to the practice, to give oneself to virtue, to give oneself to training, to give oneself to the willingness to be present and peaceful, to give oneself to really living a life of integrity. And those are, it's a quality, it's not an achievement, it's not something that you get. It's something that you're willing to give yourself to. And all of the areas of generosity, of being willing to help each other out in order, and willing to share with whatever you have. Those are really the foundation of practice, or growth in practice, or shift and change in practice. Because so often the practice is really, we tend to focus on what we're trying to get, to achieve, to accomplish, and particularly we're just beginning the three month retreat, so I'd really caution people on getting swept up in that kind of striving. And look to more of a heart relationship to the practice, in that one is willing to give to it, and willing to pay attention to other, into the areas of giving that help to support that, because a generosity of spirit is such a necessary part of practice, and again sort of lays that foundation for a steadiness of practice, because if we're always sort of say putting forth effort and then measuring it to see if we're successful or not successful, or how much results, or what kind of results? Then it's on a certain level, it's always going to be unsatisfactory, because whatever it is, it's never going to be enough. The nature of desire is that it's not going to be fulfilled. So that quality of generosity and giving is a quality that we bring in on a very fundamental level to our training, and it affects everything. Of course, this time in Thailand, being there, then word is starting to spread of the kind of reception hall project, and people were very generous and keen to help out, and as well as helping with Pacific Hermitage. So it's really is actually very moving and touching. Or, So the I think one, and of course one of the qualities that is, or maybe a couple intertwined qualities, that also come up as we relate to practice and the kind of the webs of relationship that we have as practitioners, because we rely on a web of spiritual friendship, and that kind of Kalyana Mitta is not just having, say, kind of good friends in your kind of in the monastery or the Buddhist group, but it just is, because when I think of how the Buddha described himself as a Kalyanamitta to the world, so that you realize, well, the Buddha himself is a model of Kalyanamitta, so that all of the different range of support and encouragement that we get from teachers and the fellow practitioners and the monastic community, lay community. There's just these webs of relationship and support, and that kind of gratitude and appreciation that arises from that is to me is very 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 strong, and it's something that being able to recognize those kind of webs of support, and then there's that quality of respect and gratitude, which is in the where we do the chanting for the house blessings or blessings of whatnot. One of the chants that is always used is the Mangala Sutta, so the chant on the highest blessings, and one of the verses, Garla Vocha Niwatocha Santuchi Jagatanyuta Kale Natama Sawanang Eta Mangala Mutamang. So that God, respectfulness and of humble ways, contentment and gratitude, hearing the Dhamma frequently taught, these are the highest blessings. And so that those qualities are really important for supporting us in our practice, allowing that quality of steady practice to establish itself. Those aspects of mutual respect, respectfulness, a sense of respect, appreciation, and the humility of humble ways. Niwatocha is sort of like, not lifting oneself up. They're saying it's kind of the opposite of how in Thai, and there's a Thai idiom of when somebody starts to kind of assert themselves from a kind of a self position, and sort of pricking up one's ears and stretching out one's tail. Dog sort of establishing their position in the kind of the pecking order, and it doesn't have a particularly beautiful quality. So that the opposite is this quality of niwato, of not having to carry around that sense of self, not having to push that sense of self outwards. And that there's qualities of contentment, just learning how to be content, and whether with its external conditions or with internal conditions, learning how to understand oneself so clearly that one can be content with oneself, which doesn't mean complacent, but it's also being able to recognize one's strengths and one's weaknesses, being able to develop the areas of wholesome skill that allow oneself to deploy the strength skillfully, and to not be hooked by the one's weaknesses, not to be identified with them. And again, the qualities of gratitude. So those lay a wholesome foundation of the mind, so that one really can listen to Dhamma, to be able to hear Dhamma, and not just hearing it with the ears, but really hearing it with the heart. Being able to hear the Dhamma so that it really allows one to transform, to change. And it's not just more information or more kind of knowledge, but it's the basis of understanding, so that we can really live in accordance with Dhamma, in accordance with truth. So that these are ways of reflecting on practice there's a heart connection to the practice that is really important to be reflecting on, and that because these are. This is something that kind of comes up from sort of seeing, being in, back in that environment of say, particularly our monasteries and the culture it's been steeped in Buddhism for so long. So offer that for reflection this evening.